Railway collision at Wimborne, a mostly true story. Wimborne Station, well before dawn, one Thursday in late November 1894. Under the booking hall canopy stand two men. One, Scott, gesticulates at the firmly shut door. "Not here again, George. Third time this week. Don't know why they keep Watts on. He's always sleeping in." The other man, George White, shrugs his shoulders as best he can, loaded down with a basket of rabbits on each arm. "Wait a bit, see if he turns up. 10 minutes till the train's off. But if he stays abed, gets the train and pay at the other end. Not the first time." Just before 5:45, the two give up, walk through the subway under the tracks and up the stairs to the platform where their train, six carriages and two vans, is ready to leave for Poole and Bournemouth. Charles Bridle, the guard and a Wimborne man, is loading parcels into the rearmost van. He steps back onto the platform, ready to give the right-of-way to the driver at 5:50. In the warm glow of the hissing gas lamp, he sees the men coming up the steps. George nods to the guard, who's covered this shift all week. "Watts is still abed, no ticket." Chaz raises an eyebrow. "Pay in pool." Nodding again, George manoeuvres himself and his baskets into the middle compartment of the carriage next to the guard's van. Scott is just about to follow when, through the carriage window, he spots Watts, the errant booking clerk, running across the station forecourt. Scott rushes back to the ticket office, pays his fivepence halfpenny fare, and gets back just in time to scramble into the front compartment of White's carriage. The two men are the only passengers. Meanwhile, nearly 30 feet up in the station's tall signal box, the lighthouse, Isaac Palmer looks forward to finishing his 12-hour shift, just minutes away at 6:00. Warmed by the fire at his back, Isaac has a commanding view of the line to the north, curving sharply eastwards past the town's gasworks, and to the south, across the River Stour. When it opened 20 years ago, the box had the latest equipment, but the block instruments are now a little dated. Still, properly used, they make sure there's only one train on any particular section of track, making travel much safer than it had been a generation earlier. A long shift, but not a busy one once the mail train from London had passed through at 1:38. After 9 years in the box, Isaac knows the ropes. The engine for the Bournemouth train had come down from the sheds at Wimborne Junction, just over the river, in plenty of time for Isaac to let the whole train out from the sidings at 5:39, holding it at the platform by keeping the starting signal just beyond the platform ramp at danger. Everything set for departure. Isaac has one more job to do before he knocks off, signalling the Weymouth-bound express goods train. Leaving London's Nine Elms at 12:20 a.m, it picks up and drops off wagons at the more important places. Brockenhurst's the last stop before Wimborne. The train's scheduled to be at the station at 5:23, but this morning, as more often than not, it's late, trundling down the track some 3 or 4 miles to the east, approaching Udden's level crossing and its signal box. Isaac has everything in hand. At 5:42, the Udden signalman sounds the bell in Isaac's box, ding ding, and then, with barely a pause, thrice again, ding ding ding, warning Isaac that the goods train's finally coming. There's little for him to do. Because the passenger train is at the platform, Isaac leaves the home signal over 300 yards to the train's rear at danger, its red oil lamp clearly visible for several hundred yards to the crew of the approaching goods train. Another 700 yards east, around the curve past the gasworks and just short of the bridge taking North Lye Lane over the railway, is the distance signal. This too shows a red light, warning approaching trains that the home signal is at danger. There's plenty of time to stop. At 5:45, the Udden's bell at Wimborne's signal box sounds again, ding ding, and Isaac knows that the goods train has just passed the level crossing at Udden's. He rings the bell on the down platform where the Bournemouth train stands to warn of the approaching goods train. Isaac relaxes, confident that in just a few minutes the passenger train will be on its way, after which he can hand over responsibility for the goods train to the small box controlling the shunting yard just a short distance away, and then home for breakfast and bed. The engine crew of the goods train, William Payne and William Hammond, are also old hands. Payne's been in the service for 27 years, 14 as driver. Hammond for 20, although after an unfortunate incident 6 months ago, he'd been busted down to fireman after 11 years driving. They've been on duty a little over 7 hours, bringing the train all the way from London. Signals clear all the way from Brockenhurst, and the train passes Uddon's Crossing at about 30 miles per hour. Quite fast enough for 29 loaded but unbraked wagons and 2 brake vans. Apart from steam-powered and handbrakes on the engine and its tender, these 2 brake vans are the only way to stop the train. The guard, George Lambert, 38 years in the service, 28 of them on goods trains, is in the front brake van with another brakesman at the rear. George is in charge of the train, but he has no way of communicating directly with the driver. Just past Uddon's, Bill Payne prepares to stop at Wimborne, shutting off steam so the train will coast the next couple of miles to the station. He screws down the tender's handbrake so they're just rubbing the wheels, ready for a harder application if needed. Then, bang! One of the glass gauges measuring the water level in the boiler bursts, filling the cab with a mixture of scalding water and steam. This happens once in a while, and Bill knows what to do. Protecting his face with a rag, he braves the searing heat and moves towards the broken gauge. But the isolating cock is stiff, and it's 3 or 4 minutes before he forces the valve shut. Meanwhile, the goods train has coasted as far as the North Lye Bridge, passing the distance signal without either man noticing its red warning lamp. George Lambert and his brakesmen have spotted the red light though, and as the train's still doing around 25 miles per hour, the brakesman screws down his handbrake. The train slows a little, and George isn't too worried until a few moments later he spots the home signal at danger. Now he screws his brake down hard. He realises the train's going too fast to stop in time, but he can't alert the driver. More precious seconds pass. It's not until the train has crossed the bridge over the old turnpike that William Hammond, the fireman, spots wagons in the adjoining sidings and shouts a warning to his driver. Straight away, Bill Payne applies the engine's steam brake, but now the train's just 30, 20 yards from the home signal. It's really not Bill's day. The steam pipe to the brake fractures, making the brake useless. Bill's fireman desperately screws down the tender brakes, and Bill himself puts the engine into reverse, the driving wheels spinning backwards, slipping uselessly along the rails. He sounds the engine's whistle as a warning. The train passes the home signal at danger, still doing, perhaps, 15 miles per hour. Up in the signal box, Isaac Palmer has already spotted the unfolding drama as the train comes too fast around the curve. He runs to the large sliding windows at the front of the box, waves a red lamp at the approaching train and shouts, "Go ahead with the train," to Chaz Bridle, the guard, standing on the platform. Chaz in turn runs towards his engine, shouting the same instruction to the driver. Ignoring the starting signal still at danger, the passenger train inches forwards. But it's too late. The passenger train's only moved a few yards when the goods train enters the platform at between 6 and 8 miles an hour, smashing into the back of the passenger guard's van and propelling the whole passenger train forward. More bad luck. The collision shatters the brake pipe on the passenger train, causing it to shudder to a halt. The heavy goods train crashes again into the now stationary passenger train, smashing the luggage van to pieces and crushing the first 2 compartments of the next vehicle, the coach with the 2 passengers. Silence, except for the hiss of steam escaping from the broken brake pipe. The two guards are fine. Both are safe on the platform, George having nimbly stepped out of his brake van just seconds before the collision. The locomotive crews are okay too, protected by their engine's sturdy metalwork. But it's not quite as good news for the passengers. Chaz Bridle quickly searches the smashed coach and finds Scott in the front compartment. He's banged his head, but otherwise seems all right. Indeed, he'll be off on the next passenger train south some hours later. George White isn't in such good shape. Chaz finds him lying on the floor in the middle compartment, the first not to be smashed to bits, so in a way George has had a lucky escape. But he's badly knocked about, his injuries requiring urgent medical attention. Within minutes, a doctor arrives, takes one look at George and sends him to the Cottage Hospital on the other side of Wimborne. Their doctor all diagnoses serious internal injuries. The station's a mess, but railway discipline, rules and procedures kick in. In the signal box, bells sound repeatedly as Isaac Palmer sends obstruction danger to the neighbouring signal boxes, halting all trains. William Forward, the station master, is hauled from bed to take charge. Telegraph wires hum, whizzing messages to around a dozen officials, some as far away as London. Fortunately, Wimborne's such an important railway centre that most of the men and equipment needed are local, although clearing the worst of the wreckage must await the arrival of the steam crane from Eastleigh. In just a few hours, the main tracks are cleared and repaired, trains running normally. The only obvious sign of the crash is the splintered wood and bent metal of the destroyed vehicles piled up in the station yard. But by law, there has to be a reckoning. And within days, the man from the ministry, or rather an inspector from the railway department of the Board of Trade, arrives in Wimborne to inspect the scene and interview the railway staff involved. Major Marenden's report is with his bosses on Christmas Eve, under a month since the crash. He's in no doubt that the crew of the goods engine are to blame for missing the two signals, although he does allow that the men were very unfortunately placed owing to the gauge glass breaking and the steam pipe failing. The railway company is no doubt relieved not to be found at fault. It suspends William Payne, the driver, from duty, losing him £12.7 and 6 in pay. But it doesn't all go the London and South Western Railway's way. Major Marenden observes that the signalman, Isaac Palmer, was, strictly speaking, in breach of regulations by allowing the goods train to approach Wimborne before the passenger train had left. But the inspector finds no fault with Isaac because he was only following a procedure that the company had allowed to evolve. Instead, the major recommends that the LSWR brings its regulation into line with other railway companies, the better to deal with this kind of situation. The regs do get changed, but not for some years. And what about our injured passenger, George White? The inspector says that no one was seriously hurt, but in truth, George is in a poor way. He spends nearly a month in bed, and it's not until the 8th of March that, against medical advice, he tries to go back to work. As well as suffering a lot of pain, he's lost a lot of money and sues the London and South Western Railway for damages. The case comes to court in June before a jury. The railway mounts a vigorous defence, employing a QC, Mr. Bucknell, who parades a series of high-ranking officials as well as some of the railway staff involved. Bucknell argues that as George didn't have a ticket, he was not, in law, a passenger and therefore not entitled to damages. The judge thinks little of this defence, but it allows it to go forward to the jury in case the railway can prove that Watts was not late for work and that passengers never paid their fare in pool. But Scott, the other passenger, comes to court to confirm that the clerk barely arrived before the train was due to leave. In cross-examination, Chaz Bridle, the guard, admits that George had tried to buy a ticket. It doesn't take long for the jury to find in George's favour, to the sum of £100. In fairness, Watt's persistent tardiness might have been down to illness. Although he lived for nearly another 30 years, dying in service in his late 50s, his career was punctuated by several, sometimes lengthy, periods of sick leave. And so our characters fade back into the obscurity of the past, as does the stage on which they all played on that misty morning in November 1894. Wimborne Station closed to passengers in 1964, and while some of the buildings survived in varying degrees of decrepitude until the early 1980s, the site was then levelled and is now marked by no more than a green plaque mounted on an industrial unit. Walk about half a mile to North Lye Lane, however, and you can still stand on the bridge looking down at the old track bed right by the site of the first signal that William Payne missed. Perhaps if you stand there on a dark morning this November, you will still be able to hear the echo of the engine's whistle warning of impending disaster.